I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
Wow.
We're in the kitchen in The Guardian. It's my first time in the office this year, actually. And what a day coming in for the budget. And I think we're all about to get our phones confiscated, the internet turned off. I don't know. It's a bit mysterious how it's going to work. On Tuesday, Guardian journalists in Sydney and Canberra came into the office, had their phones confiscated, their internet switched off, and then were given the 2021 to 2022 budget. How many budgets is this, Elias?
This is my second budget. So
it was the first one last year?
It was, yeah.
So only COVID budgets for you?
Only COVID budgets for me. I'm a COVID budget baby.
After a tough year with multiple missteps from the Morrison government and with the next election on the horizon, some, such as Guardian editor Lenore Taylor and political editor Catherine Murphy, say this budget is Morrison's attempt at forging a roadmap to political recovery. But has he done enough to win over the Australian public? Today, will this pandemic recovery budget make over the Morrison government? It's Wednesday, the 12th of May. David Monk, how's your budget day going?
As well as can be expected.
What are you up to right now?
I'm reading a piece by Paul Carr about migration and how future migrants and their families will not be able to benefit from government payments until they've been here for 4 years, which is a change.
Mike, star of the Friday podcast and on Full Story, we're getting first reactions to the budget. What are you doing?
I'm scouring the budget for smaller items that may not find their way into our major stories, just items of curiosity or things that may have been forgotten that sometimes seem like large items, such as environment and perhaps Indigenous affairs, but other just one-off curious weird things that money has been allocated for in the budget and putting them into a big document.
Anton, how is your budget day going?
Well, it's my first lock up and it's going interesting. I've had terrible coffee from the coffee pod. I can't get out to get a decent coffee, and that's been a real challenge for me.
Nick, what are you up to right now?
I'm just listening to Bonobo and programming an interactive chart.
What are you doing with this chart?
So what we're doing right now is we're having a look at how we thought things would turn out in 2019, pre-pandemic, in terms of the surplus or deficit, and then we're comparing that to how things have actually turned out. And what you can see right now is it starts off with a little surplus, which the government thought they were going to get, and then it turns into a massive deficit.
So Ben Frydenberg says that the recovery from the pandemic is going quicker than expected, and this budget predicts that that will continue with GDP growing significantly and a bunch of other promising sounding figures. What jumps out to you?
I think this is probably the biggest call.
Ben Butler is Guardian Australia's senior business reporter.
Predicting that unemployment will fall below 5% by the end of 2022 and below 4.75% by the middle of the next year.
And which is quite low, yes.
That is low in Australia. And a sustained low unemployment rate like that hasn't been seen since the global financial crisis. Mm. So that is probably the biggest economic forecast in there. And these are not enormous figures, and an unemployment rate of 4.75% is still a lot of people out of work. So although they are a big turnaround from where we are now, in terms of where the end point is, it's not really hugely ambitious for Australia.
But generally, Frydenberg says that the overall economy will recover well over the next few years. How?
Frydenberg's relying on the economy itself to do a lot of the work. He's quite bullish on the prospects of recovery from coronavirus recession, possibly because it's a different type of shock. You know, this is a pandemic. It's not the global financial system imploding on itself or anything like that. It's something that's been imposed from outside, and he's banking on the Australian economy coming back from it reasonably strongly, but not massively strongly.
So he reckons we'll bounce back, but he doesn't have to do too much to get us there. Is that correct?
He reckons he has to do bugger all, that the heavy lifting will be done by the booming iron ore price, which is today at around up to US$230 a tonne, which is enormous. The central price in the budget papers is $160 US a tonne, declining to 55 US a tonne over time. So he's got, you know, plenty of upside there potentially. And by consumers coming out of their shells, ordinary people coming out of their shells, out of their, you know, coronavirus hobbit holes, and spending up big at shops, essentially, and at things like hairdressers and stuff like that, services. So that's the what he's sort of banking on.
Do you think that he's too optimistic in this assessment that will bounce back naturally?
Well, I hope he's right. It would be great. There are always plenty of risks, though. You know, we still got no wages growth in this country and haven't done for a long time. I don't see anything in this budget that's going to stimulate wages growth. I'm not quite sure why he thinks unemployment will go down like that, absent some other measures to sort of increase unemployment in Australia by spending lots of money, which is doesn't happen in this budget. And, you know, it's sort of, who knows what will happen with China? Like the iron ore, if they were to decide they could get their iron ore from somewhere else, which they cannot at the moment, it's physically impossible. But if they were to develop Simandou, the world's biggest iron ore deposit in Africa, nicknamed the Pilbara Killer, then we would be in heaps and heaps of strife all of a sudden. The iron ore price would collapse and, you know, it's just, you know, Treasury has a history of getting these numbers wrong and being basically too optimistic over time. And I think you can excuse them in the 2019 budget. No one could see a pandemic coming. But I hope I'm wrong and their numbers are actually right or, in fact, underdone.
So he's banking on some big things going right for Australia, and we'll have to wait and see.
We always do, don't we? I mean, what else can you do? Hold on.
Let me just put this a little bit closer to you, though, sorry.
Okay.
Good one. So, Anne, we know that support for Morrison has fallen amongst women. Is it fair to say that this budget is trying to address that?
Yes, well, I think they really are trying to make amends and show that they do understand the needs of women.
Anne Davies is an investigative reporter at Guardian Australia who's taken a look at the impact of this budget on women.
Well, I think it's interesting that the government actually did a separate statement, or the women's budget statement. That's what they do when they really want to highlight an issue.
So they don't always do that in every budget?
No. So, and in the past they've done things like the ageing population when that's been an issue. So I think it really is an effort to take it more seriously. Now, whether it's enough, I guess we'll find out in the next few days and weeks as people assess the budget. But there are some significant things in there. Like there's measures in childcare which are about trying to address the problem that a lot of women have, that it's just too hard to work 5 days a week because the childcare assistance runs out. And also there's some changes to superannuation which are focused on people who earn less than $450 a week. Now, that's often part-time workers, women, and so they're trying to address that as well.
I notice there's a chunk of money, $1.1 billion for domestic violence, and that's been such a big part of the national conversation, especially recently. We've had some horrifying cases. What is the government planning to do about this?
Well, they're basically giving a fair chunk of the money to states for frontline services, and that's obviously where it's going to be most effective. They're also focusing some of it on Indigenous communities and also on non-English speaking background people and refugees.
Something I noticed was a new payment, I think. Can you talk me through that in the domestic violence space?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's one interesting thing they're doing, which is a fund to allow people who are the subject of domestic violence to apply for $1,500 cash and additional funds to get set up in a new house. Now, the government had announced that people could access their superannuation if they're victims of domestic violence, but they seem to have dumped that idea in favour of these more direct grants, which seems to me quite sensible.
Instead of women kind of taking out of their super, they've got a special payment for that, basically.
Yeah. And considering also that women are already lagging behind in their super.
What about the issue of sexual harassment?
Yes, well, the government's got this Respect at Work program, and there are more funds allocated to assist on that, and including advertising campaigns and also just, you know, trying to improve workplace conditions by making sure employers understand what their obligations are as well.
And this has come off the back of an inquiry.
Yeah, well, Kate Jenkins made 55 recommendations, I think, and now they're putting some money behind it. So there'll obviously need to be more, but it's a good start.
So, Sarah, aged care looks to be one of the big priorities in this budget with a $17.7 billion package. Where are all those billions of dollars going?
Okay, well, there's a lot of money going out the door over 5 years.
Sarah Martin is Guardian Australia's chief political correspondent.
So the most important thing is the $6.5 billion for an additional 80,000 home care packages. Now, home care packages was a huge problem identified by the Royal Commission. We know that people were dying on the waiting list, waiting for home care packages, and often they were not getting the level of need met through the packages that they were granted. So this has been a really big problem that the Royal Commission highlighted, and this funding will allegedly clear the waiting list over the next 2 years, ensuring another 80,000 people get packages that they need, which will mean about 275,000 packages funded by 2023. Another big part of the package is about $8 billion, which is basically to improve residential aged care services. There's obviously been huge problems about some of the viability of the sector and also the standard of care that people are getting in those homes. And so part of the changes that the government has announced, and again, this was in response to the recommendations in the Royal Commission, is a mandated level of care for people. So, for example, there's about $4 billion, which will ensure that residents get about 200 minutes per day of frontline care, and that includes about 40 minutes with a registered nurse. And then the third big spending element of this package, and you know, there's a lot of different elements, but the third big one is on residential aged care quality and safety. And then, of course, there's a big workforce package as well, which aims to address what we know is a huge problem with worker shortages.
$17.7 billion sounds like a lot of money. Is this what we were expecting here?
Look, it is a lot of money. There's no doubt about it. And that's over a five-year period. And it does bring the total amount that the government is spending on aged care. At the end of the forward estimates, it's basically the same amount of money that the government is spending on Medicare more broadly. So it is a lot of money. There's no doubt about it. And a lot of money is needed.
Okay.
I'll stop typing. Cool.
So, Elias, it seems like mental health is one of the priorities in the budget with just over $2 billion in funding. Where is that money going?
Yeah, so I think the big news is there's $2.3 billion for mental health, and it's largely aimed at a few things.
Elias Visonte is a reporter at Guardian Australia.
Predominantly this new network of 40 mental health clinics that the government's going to be calling Head to Health, and that's going to cater to Australians over 25 and really anyone who's not covered in Headspace, which has previously existed for 12 to 25-year-olds.
And anything else?
Yeah, well, so the government's also going to invest a bit more in Headspace. It'll build another 10 clinics for that. And the other big ticket item is that the government will establish a new National Suicide Prevention Office, which it says will help establish a whole-of-government approach to suicide. Things like whenever someone goes into hospital after a suicide attempt, it's really going to make sure services follow them. And it's also going to try and expand services to anyone who exhibits any suicidal thoughts at any point in the health system. But it's pretty light on detail so far as to exactly how those programs are going to work. And it obviously argues that the Headspace and the Head to Health Centres are going to be that early intervention too, so it hopefully doesn't get to that stage.
So overall, it sounds like it's targeting young people, but making sure that people over 25 aren't left out, and suicide prevention. Would that be right?
Yeah, and I think there's a good acknowledgement of the fact that the existing framework really catered a lot to that 12 to 25 cohort, but that suicide really is still the leading cause of death in Australians aged 18 to 44.
We know that people are falling through the cracks in our mental health system. The Guardian's just done a big project looking at that. Is this what experts and people working in the sector were asking for from mental health funding from the government?
Yeah, look, I don't think they'll be upset seeing it, but I think they might be a bit frustrated because one of the key things that experts and even the Productivity Commission's been calling for was an increase in how many sessions with a psychologist Medicare will provide for Australians. You know, currently it's at 20 per year, but that's just a temporary doubling during COVID, but that's set to return to just 10 sessions per year in June next year. And there's no real additional money for Medicare and mental health in this budget.
So it's going to stay at 20 and go back down to 10?
Well, that's what it looks like now, yeah.
Next, Lenore Taylor and Catherine Murphy on Morrison's unambitious budget. Hello, welcome to the pod room. I'm just getting Murph in as well.
Okay.
So Murph, Lenore, this is my first budget.
Oh, welcome.
Oh, Lenora.
Lenora.
Thank you.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah, it's my third. I think it's my 33rd.
I'm not counting deliberately. and we've had 35 budgets over the last 18 months, let's be honest.
Yes, so there's that.
True. So, Lenore, how would you describe this budget, your 33rd?
So, look, it prioritises spending on extending tax breaks and on a bunch of new services on aged care and childcare and mental health. And they're not bad priorities for a society that's hauling itself out of a pandemic trauma. But I guess my criticism would be that it doesn't really chart a new way forward. It continues the work of pulling us out of the pandemic, which we're doing better than a lot of other countries. It doesn't really have a big vision for the future.
Charts a middle path. What would you say, Murph? How would you describe it?
Yes, it's a very astute observation, obviously, from Lenore, and I agree substantially. It's a funny budget in this sense. It's a absolutely keeping your options open budget in terms of election timing. I think this budget is highly suggestive that the government is leaving open the idea of going to the polls later in the year, just because of the nature of the measures and the craft around the storytelling. I think it's suggestive of that. But it's sort of weirdly a placeholder budget too, in that it's sort of It kind of starts a conversation about a bunch of important things, particularly aged care and mental health, to really pressing needs in this country in a policy sense. But it basically defers a whole bunch of tough questions that are associated with those conversations in those policy areas for another day, right?
And it kind of has a bob each way, doesn't it? Because it hasn't done away with those massive tax cuts for high income earners that are in the Ford estimate. So they're still there. The old we're the low taxing guys policies are still there sort of in the back cupboard. But and it extends some of the last budget's, you know, COVID emergency tax cuts for business and for low and middle income earners. So there's still a bit of that. And then it does, as you say, the spending on services, which are, you know, essential services, things that we as a society need. But I don't really see the narrative that pulls that all together, the ideological through line through all of that.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting if we Sorry, Laura, I imagine you have a question rather than us just grabbing
the
microphone
every 5 minutes. No, I'd love to hear what you're saying.
No. All I was going to say is that if you sort of, it's an interesting kind of thought experiment to draw a through line between the October budget last year, which was a very on-brand coalition budget, which is private sector recovery, cut all the taxes, everybody wins, through to this budget in May, which is a sort of a kicking into the wind budget in terms of where the public is at about the role of government in the pandemic, i.e. we want governments to be more present. It's not enough to just step back and say, look, here's the private sector recovery, it'll all be sweet. In this budget, the government's recognised that they need to lean into a more present version of government, and that's been shaped by the pandemic. But the sort of prescription for sort of these kind of divided identities that Lenore's talking about, how do you push those two things together? Well, there's a very unfulfilling explanation in the budget, and it's basically, look, economic growth will return and economic growth will service the debt and allow us to do all this spending while cutting taxes. Now, that's bollocks. Just not to put too fine a point on it. That's not going to happen. We had a low growth economy prior to the pandemic.
And we're going back there.
The budget papers tell us that we're going back there.
One of the biggest news stories over the past couple of months has been our vaccination rollout. Did we learn anything new about that in this budget?
We did.
That
no,
we're all
we going to
get two
things.
Shots yeah. by the end of the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Boom, boom.
What did you think about that?
I thought, huzzah, I thought. And we also learned that we're spending some more money, I forget how much, like another couple of billion on buying more vaccines and getting them out there.
Yes.
Which ones? Do we know?
No idea. And also that we are developing capacity for the production of mRNA vaccinations in Australia.
Once
but
again, huzzah.
Yes, huzzah. But sorry, guys, voters, we can't tell you anything about that. That's all subject to commercial negotiations that are underway presently. So, yeah, we did learn a few bits and pieces.
So to sum it up, they're kind of on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, they are. Well, they were off it.
They weren't on it, but now they're on it.
Okay, we're back
good.
On track. Mm. Yeah. So as I mentioned, this is my first budget lockup, and something that kind of surprised me is that there didn't seem to be a section really for Indigenous affairs. There are a lot of measures scattered throughout all different parts of it, and it didn't touch on some of the big conversations that are going on, you know, changes to the justice system, a voice to parliament. I mean, is this approach normal?
So I can distinctly remember when there were Indigenous portfolio statements, but I guess it only happens when there is spending in that specific portfolio. And so I assume it's a function of there not being a lot of spending initiatives. Those conversations are only going to appear in the budget if they involve spending in this year. That's the only time they're going to show up. And the initiatives that are there were actually slotted into other portfolios, so into the health portfolio or the employment portfolio or the women's budget or whatever else. Mm. So I think it's a function of the construction of this budget.
Mm. I mean, there was significant measures put towards Indigenous women in the domestic violence sector, but I didn't see anything else too ambitious. I don't know whether you guys did.
No, and that's a fair call. And I think obviously if you're going to have a women's statement in the budget, it does open a conversation about whether or not there should be a First Nations statement also. Again, it sort of gets back to that point about ambition.
Mm. Murph, in your column, you called this budget an official expression of emotional intelligence. What do you mean by that?
Well, it sort of picks up Lenore's point a minute ago where we've sort of got to think about the run-up to this budget and where the government was at politically. So we had last October in the blokes budget, then we've had the Me Too moment that's been visited on the parliament by Brittany Higgins, the former Liberal staffer. Obviously the Prime Minister has been all at sea on that through the first quarter of 2021. And so the principal complaint raised against Morrison during that period is he wasn't listening, he wasn't connected to the circumstances of women and in 2021. I think I can see a lot of storytelling in this budget, implicit storytelling, which is that actually we are connected. Actually, we do understand. Mm. Here's billions that sort of demonstrate that we understand that you're caring for ageing parents and the whole system's crook. We understand that you're caring for adolescents with severe mental health problems. Mm. Here's some billions to try and sort that out. So I think there's craft. I mean, there's obviously need, profound need behind these spending decisions, but there's also craft. And I think it's that's what I mean about EQ. That Morrison wants this budget to basically propel a personal recovery for him after a really shaky start to the year.
Mm.
And he wants the story the government's telling to be not, we're not listening, we're disconnected from you, we don't understand your concerns. He wants the story to be, we absolutely get your concerns. And here's a bunch of billions sprinkled over the forward estimates demonstrating this.
Do these key funding announcements for, you know, women, aged care and mental health sufficiently address the need that we see in these areas?
I think our critique, although Lenore and I haven't caucused, so I'm not entirely certain what Lenore's critique would be, but I think both of us would probably say, you know, reasonable down payment, not far enough on some of these measures. And there are, we've sort of got to over the next few days drill more into the quality of this spend.
Mm.
But there are some decent things, particularly in mental health.
Mm.
I just want to say that Christine Morgan, who is Scott Morrison's suicide prevention advisor, has done a really good job knitting together some initiatives on the suicide prevention front that I honestly believe, if they're properly crafted, will save lives.
But I would question whether there's also priorities there which are sort of extensions of Headspace type
correct.
Services. Yeah. And I think that the need is actually in what, you know, everyone calls the missing middle, but in providing more affordable access to psychology and psychiatry for people
that's
who aren't hospitalised
right.
and yeah. who aren't yet suicidal but who are, you know, quite unwell and more unwell than Headspace can probably handle.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And yeah, look, that I think the mental health system basically needs to be blown up and start again.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, I think it does. I think it's terrible and it's perverse and it, in fact, makes some people sicker. But... yeah, just on that microcosm of suicide prevention, that commitment basically that everybody who has a suicide attempt who ends up in hospital will be given care mm-hmm. when they leave the hospital. It's such a simple thing. It's extraordinary that it's not happening now, but the fact is it's not. And if this is properly designed, it'll save lives.
We've touched on this a little, but what has been left behind or completely left out of this budget?
Well, the environment is entirely missing, or almost entirely missing. And I think the big missed opportunity is that if you are going to do some government pump priming, if you need to spend money, you could use, and you also know that you need to transform your economy into a low emissions economy. Those two aims would seem to dovetail quite nicely, and many other governments around the world have seen that opportunity, but this government is still going on about a gas-led recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And so what can you do? So I would say that's the biggest missed opportunity in the budget. And then just ambition in a way,
mm-hmm.
in that, you know, yes, the economy rebounds next year to 4.5% growth or something like that, but then it kind of chugs along at 2.25%, 2.5%. And yes, unemployment is forecast to come down to have a 4 in front of it. Well, that's great. That's terrific. That's good job creation. However, we don't know what that's going to do to wages. That nexus between lower unemployment and wage rises has been broken, and we don't know if that is going to work. And I think at this moment in history, if you like, where there's you know, we've been through profound trauma, but that also gives an opportunity for profound change. And I just don't know. I think they've done what Murph was talking about, ticked boxes that are both addressing need and addressing their political need, but it's not the ambitious transformational budget that it could be at this point.
Murph and Lenore, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And see you in the office soon.
See you next year for your second budget.
For your for Laura's
the
second
and the fourth
budget.
And right up to the 33rd.
God help us all.
Wonderful, my ladies. That's it for today. Thanks so much to everyone that helped to make this episode, including Nick Evershed, Mike Tischer, Anton Issa, Anne Davies, Elias Visonte, Sarah Martin, Catherine Murphy, and Lenore Taylor. To learn more about what's in this budget, follow The Guardian's coverage at theguardian.com. Plus, we've put some links to some key stories on the full story page, including Murph's opinion piece titled Budget 2021. Make no mistake, this is a keeping options open for an election this year budget. This episode was produced by myself, Miles Martignoni, and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.